Not sure if you get outside a few nights ago to see the harvest moon, but here in the desert it was hanging so big and beautiful and low in the sky as it rose here in the desert. Thought we'd play a little song by Neil Young there, maybe the prettiest song Neil Young ever wrote, Harvest Moon from 1992. We're talking with Bill Burns, author, publisher, and TV star, the guy who hosted the UFO Hunters TV show, telling us about his new book, which is a behind-the-scenes look at that program and some of the cases it investigated. Coming up, the Mexican Roswell case and what Bill Burns calls his favorite UFO story of all time. Much more to come on Coast to Coast AM. Before the break, Bill, we were talking about difficulties you encountered in dealing with the UFO community in general and specific individuals in particular. It is a field that is proprietary. I mean, people who work on a story consider it to be their story, even though it's not something that they might own. And it's parochial too, in the sense that everybody wants to be right. They want their version of UFO reality to be right, so they might not always cooperate with a guy like you, even though if your show comes to town and gives a lot of attention to a UFO case, it in fact could trigger a book deal or a movie deal for somebody who's been sitting on the stuff for a long time.
You're absolutely right. And that was exactly our presentation to a lot of people, saying, look, you've been working on this story for, I mean, in the case of Kelso, this is a story going back to 1947. You've been working on this story for decades. You've been amalgamating all this information. This is your chance for the kind of publicity with you on camera telling your story and what you know. We're not here to pirate your story. We're here to showcase you telling your story. And so that was our approach in Kelso. That was our approach in Stephenville. I mean, literally, that was our approach in Stephenville. And if you thought that Kelso was a bee's nest, Stephenville was a bigger bee's nest, because you had all these different entities, MUFON, the local newspaper, other investigators, all involved, all securing their own witnesses who wouldn't talk to anybody else. So we basically had to thread our needle. It was a great episode, but we had to thread the needle by amalgamating what we could using the video, and made a lot of enemies. But at the same time, we got a great story out that really showed at the end of the day that the folks who said they were seeing something were indeed seeing something.
And in fact, since your episode came out, a lot of other information has been sort of correlated to buttress that case even more.
Especially the radar information, which
Yep.
really showed that there was, in fact, activity in the skies over Stephenville that night, independently corroborating what the witnesses in the video showed.
And which the military lied about.
They lied about it, and then they lied about their own lie.
I want to jump to Mexico briefly because I thought that was one of the most entertaining stories. I'm sure it wasn't entertaining for you at the time, but you had one heck of a trip to Mexico to check out a couple of different cases and incidents. I mean, intercepted by the Federales, guns pointed at you, thieves went after you. I mean, it was a one tough trip.
It was, and imagine you're on a bus, a pink bus, by the way. This is like I forget the story of this group of people going through the California desert, but we're on this pink bus driving all across Mexico, and a whole crew on a bus where the bathroom breaks, and you've got smokers, you've got non-smokers, you've got these bus drivers, these poor two bus drivers who could barely speak English and were having to eat our meals on the bus. And I mean, it was a nightmare in just in terms of travel. And at the height of that nightmare, with broken bathrooms, buses breaking down, you name it, we stop for, I guess they were doing a rest stop. And so this one driver, so the deal was one driver always has to stay awake to guard the bus, and the other driver can nap out. So we're all sleeping. Suddenly, we hear this movement in the bus. I thought it was one of the drivers just checking the equipment. somebody had sneaked onto the bus, walked past one of the sleeping drivers, walked past another driver, stole some computers and equipment, and left the bus. And we realized in the morning what had happened. The poor driver got fired, who was responsible for it, felt bad for him, but we were actually in danger and didn't realize it. And that was only one of the aspects of the trip to Mexico, which dealt with dealing with somebody from Mexican military intelligence, where the police were actually following us because they knew that we were talking to somebody from the Mexican military intelligence service. That was why in the episode and in the book, if you saw the photograph, there's like a blurry thing over this guy's face because we had to blur his face out for the episode. So he's telling us the story of how there was this strange incident of this fireball that landed in this little town called Jilitla up in the mountains. And that was an experience too. And how when the police got there, the static electricity, there was this envelope of electricity that was so intense, all the police radios shut down. So there was no communications. You've got all these police running around, not being able to communicate. And all the residents of the village were saying it was a flying saucer that had crashed. They came, they collected all the debris. We got some debris, but not that much, all the debris. And this guy was responsible for taking a cache of that debris to Mexico City, where the headquarters of intelligence was. And he was dying to tell a story. And so we're trying to find a place where he can tell a story on camera and be camouflaged. But the bus, which was this bright pink, was attracting all the attention from local municipal Mexico police. Finally, it's the federales that begin following us. And we wind up in a sugarcane field with this guy telling a story, and we're hearing sirens in the background. The guy splits. We split on the bus. We never heard from the guy again. So that was just one of the aspects. The other one was, of course, we're going to Cuyame out in the desert with Noe Torres and Ruben Uriarte. Ruben, of course, is the head of Northern California MUFON, and Noe Torres is in Texas. And they wrote the book called Mexico's Roswell. And it's about the strange crash out in the desert in Cuyame based on a report called the Deneb Report, which talks about this crash. And it's this odd report. I actually printed it in the book. It's this odd report talking about how United States military radar picks up this object coming in over Mexico heading toward Texas. Then it makes a U-turn and heads back over the Mexico desert, and there's a private plane from the United States heading into Mexico, which crashes with the object. And supposedly the two objects crash, they both come down, they're in the desert. The Mexican army sends a unit out to retrieve the debris from this. Now, this whole story is premised on the fact that the United States military has a surveillance net over Mexico. I mean, if you think there's surveillance in the United States, we surveil Mexico as if it's, you know, just like it's next door. It is next door to us. So we know exactly what's going on. So this Mexican army unit goes out. They're in the desert. They actually retrieve what's supposedly this anomalous craft, the strange craft. They pack it onto flatbeds, and they're trucking it back out of the desert when suddenly all communication stops. And, of course, the United States military is monitoring communications. They know when communication stops. So the U.S. gets nervous. So they send overflights, and what they see are the soldiers lying on the side of the road. Apparently they're dead. They're lying on the side of the road. The convoy is stalled. We send a military unit out, right, with the idea of taking the stuff that was on the flatbed, taking it to the Centers for Disease Control for decontamination and figure out what it was. We bury the bodies, and then everything else we bury in the desert and explode, blow it up. That's in the Deneb Report. Who are the people in the Deneb Report? Who wrote the report? Is it a group of extraterrestrials that are monitoring what we are doing? Is it a small group in the military monitoring what the military does? Nobody knows. So
I want to ask you about, in this case and in a couple of other cases that you mentioned in the book, UFO Hunters Book One, you do analysis of materials, the slag from Maury Harbor, objects that you found there in Mexico. You never find an incident of where you can prove it's unobtainium, some previously unknown element. And I can just hear the skeptics say, aha, that therefore it can't be from a UFO because they presume that anything from a UFO must be an element that we wouldn't know, which is ridiculous.
That's right, because if you look at the physics of the universe, whatever is here is out there. So the best thing you're going to get is some alloy that we don't make here. And if you talk to somebody like Roger Lear, for example, who's a good friend of mine, you talk to Roger Lear, and he was actually in the episode of Alien Abduction. If you talk to Roger Lear, what he will tell you is his analysis of various aspects of, call them alien implants for want of a better term, right? His analysis shows that there's a technology in the implant that doesn't exist on Earth. It's the same elements, but the technology for fabricating this doesn't exist. Now, what we found when we did our own lab analysis of one of the implants from this one person who said he'd been abducted, what we found, and Roger corroborated this, was that there was actually human flesh, this guy's own flesh, subdural, obviously, it's inside his body, but his own human flesh was growing out of the metal shard. Whatever that metallic material was, his flesh was growing out of it. And so the guy at Seal Labs who did the electron microscope analysis of it was saying, I've never seen anything like this in my life. This is the guy's flesh, clearly, but it's not just stuck to this object. It's growing out of the object. I can't explain to you how that happened. That was the closest thing we came to, quote unquote, unobtainium.
What's become of your co-hosts from the program?
At the end of season one, Pat, I'm going to see in a couple of weeks. We're having a UFO Hunters reunion sponsored by Pennsylvania MUFON here in Bucks County, Pennsylvania.
Oh.
So I'm going to see Pat. He's going to be there. Pat's been back and forth to Europe, and he and I are trying to work on what we think is a real UFO, thousands of years old, in Eastern Europe. And so we're working with Ted Phillips and Tom Ferrario, and we're amalgamating money to get out there and do a scouting expedition so we can bring it back to a network for a special. So that's one thing we're doing. So that's Pat and I. Ted had a baby and started a new business. So when season three was coming up, Ted said, look, I can't travel with you guys. I mean, I've got a brand new baby. My wife works full time. I started a whole new company called Archaic. It's up in Cambridge, and I'm just tied down. I can do a modified schedule. And so today, Ted is basically the head of a company up in Cambridge. He's still doing what he was doing before, and that's what he's up to. But that's why he wasn't there for season three, because he just had a baby.
You mentioned about Ted Phillips and this ancient UFO in Eastern Europe. Ted talked to us about it the last time I had him on the show. It's been a couple of years now, so that is an intriguing case. If it's the same one, wow, that would be fun to work on. So sort of a version of UFO Hunters will live on?
We think so. I mean, and it is the same case. Just to corroborate, that is exactly
okay.
The same case. And it is a fascinating story that has to do with something that's thousands of years old, a bunch of partisan fighters during World War II fleeing from a Nazi patrol that was after them, hiding in a cave, discovering this thing, and it's there. And the reason that Pat Uskert specifically got so excited was that he knows people from that country. He speaks the language, obviously. He was born in Eastern Europe and really has been itching to get to that object and do something. And so we think we can actually do that.
And would it be called UFO Hunters? Would it be, or would it be a special or a film, or what would it be?
There you go. Disney owns the name. It's trademarked. And so we couldn't use UFO Hunters unless it was either on A&E or History or Disney did a special on ABC. So we'd have to change the name if we didn't get their permission to use it and didn't broadcast it on any one of the Disney, of the spectrum of Disney media.
Were you tied up in any way in writing the book and using the title?
No, because what happened, the genesis of the book came, was this. The publisher that I worked with, and you know that George Noy and I have a bunch of books at this publisher, Torforge, that the publisher that I work with came up with the idea, and I may do this for Ancient Aliens, I don't know, but came up with the idea that why don't we do a book about this? And so what I did was I went back to, I asked our network exec at History who the licensing person was at History. It turns out to be at A&E. We set up a meeting with the licensing department from A&E and History and the publisher, and we all agreed to do a license deal where basically I, as author, would license the name UFO Hunters from A&E. Obviously, it's not for free, but license it from A&E, write the book, give them approval. They were, and what they agreed to do was not only use their name, but provide me with all the video that I needed, all the stills that I needed from the episodes for the photo insert for the book. And that was the nature of the deal. And it took a while to go through all the contracts departments, you can imagine. But it finally did. And that's the genesis of this book. And then the sequel book is UFO Hunters Book 2, which will probably come out late in 2014.
I want to ask you about your favorite all-time story, but we're not going to have time before the break. So we got about a minute or so. Tell me about the magazine, UFO Magazine. These are tough times for magazine publishers, but it seems like you're hanging in there.
Well, here's what we're doing, and thanks for asking. Here's what we're doing. Not only did our advertising director kick the bucket, unfortunately, so we don't know what the story is with how much we have in advertising, but our printer went out of business, was bought by somebody else, the postal regulations changed, and here's what we realized, that printing is really a dying industry. I mean, when you realize that printing is, you know, from the 15th century, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's
Gutenberg,
how old printing
yeah.
is.
Yeah.
Right? Distribution is from the 19th century. So, you know, the post office is from the 18th century. So literally, you're dealing with technologies that are hundreds of years old. What we're doing is we're transforming UFO Magazine into something that we're calling a hyperzine, which is an interactive, highly enhanced, with printing codes built in, so you could print the magazine yourself. You don't need a printer to print your own magazine. We already put the printing codes in. Folks can get the free issue, by the way. If you go to ufomag.com, there's a free issue up there for everybody. You can download and play with it and do whatever you want with it. And so we're creating these enhanced interactive magazines in which the magazine is more than just a static print copy, but something interactive in which it's its own internet. So we think that's going to revolutionize magazine publishing in the United States. We think it's brand new. We're excited about it.
I'm going to have to check that out. I tell you, I'm still enough of an old coot that I want to hold something. I'd like to have a printed copy that I put on my shelves of your magazine because I always enjoyed it. Four Tops are going to take us into the break. When we come back, Bill's favorite UFO story of all time, and then we go to your phone calls. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. So last night here in Las Vegas at the MGM Grand, they had this big event called iHeartRadio, a giant sort of music festival event, lots of stars, lots of big-name entertainers and singers and bands. But the guy who blew them all away, according to the people who were there, is that guy right there, Paul McCartney. That's McCartney and Wings from 1983, Let Me Roll It, and it still sounds pretty good. We're talking with Bill Burns, whose new book, UFO Hunters Book 1, is out, behind-the-scenes stories about investigations by that groundbreaking TV program from the History Channel. When we come back, Bill Burns' favorite UFO story of all time, and then your calls and questions for my guest here on Coast to Coast AM. Bill Burns, I thought one of the most entertaining parts of the new book, UFO Hunters, is what regarding what you call your favorite UFO story of all time. I know it's hard to put this into a couple of minutes because it's multiple stories in one, but tell us, give us the highlights and why it's your favorite.
Well, the highlights are these, that it talks about this person, a retired police constable in the UK, Alan Godfrey, who basically, without any action on his part, finds himself in the middle of hot water because he happened to see a UFO in the middle of the road in this town in Todd Morton. And the premise of this, which works for UFOs, works for the downing of TWA Flight 800, works for a whole range of things, is why would a government assert secrecy over something they said never happened, right? I mean, it defies logic. So in this particular case, Alan Godfrey, who is called out on a case because there's missing cattle. Somebody stole cattle from a pasture. So he's driving, he's trying to find it, drives down the road, and he hears on his police radio stories of unidentified flying objects flying over the area. And it's coming from other constabularies around the town of Todd Morton. And he's listening to it. It's all very nice. Comes upon, and it's been raining, which it always does in the UK, but it's raining on this November night, and it's 1980, so it's right around the time of Bentwaters. And he comes up to this object, this diamond-shaped spinning, huge diamond-shaped spinning object in the middle of the road. And one of the things he notices, but besides the shock and awe of seeing a huge object he's never seen in his life before, is the fact that it's spinning so fast that it's whirling the falling leaves into a spiral around it. And it's been raining, but he notices that the road where the object is spinning, and it's above the ground, is dry. So he doesn't know what it is. He stops his car. And he has no camera, so he starts to sketch what the object is. There's an amazing flash of light, brilliant, brilliant flash of light. And he winds up on the other side of the object, which is now gone. Now, immediately before this whole incident took place, and this also is a precursor to this, Alan Godfrey is called out. On they find a dead body on top of a coal heap. This is right in the town of right near Todd Morton. And the odd thing about this body, this is like a moment of CSI. It's a body on top of a 25-foot coal heap lying on its back. This is a coal heap, and it's been raining. The body has no coal on it, no coal under the fingernails, no coal on the clothing, no coal on the skin. A relatively clean body on top of a coal heap on its back with a face etched in pure terror. But here are two weird things. The person was clearly undressed and then redressed by someone who didn't know how clothing is affixed, right? It's buttoned the wrong way. It's just
The
odd,
zipper,
right?
yeah, the zipper was messed up. Yeah.
Exactly. But around the person's head, around the crown of the person's head, are little holes with burn marks in the holes and ointment in the holes. So Alan Godfrey gets the body, right? There's a coroner's inquest in the UK, and they say, oh, the guy died of natural causes. He died of a heart attack. Godfrey protests at that inquest, saying he could not possibly have died of a heart attack, because if he had a heart condition that bad, how did he climb up 25 feet to the top of a coal heap?
Without getting
He would
coal
just
in him.
made it to the top.
Right.
Right. And where's the coal? Where's the coal on the body? Where's the coal under his fingernails? Everything about this case is wrong. Why are you calling a death by natural circumstances? It looked as though the guy was dropped on top of a coal heap. Next thing you know, he sees this object, this UFO in the middle of the road, doesn't know what it is, tries to draw it on his clipboard, bright flash, winds up on the other side of the object is gone, runs back out of the car, looks, the road is still dry and the leaves are still in a spiral, drives back to get another constable. They drive back to the spot to confirm the fact that the road is soaking wet, but that one spot is dry and the leaves are in a spiral. Well, he lets it go. He doesn't know what it is. He's not going to worry about it. Suddenly, that story begins to hit the local British UFO community, right, Bufora. And so the story of Alan Godfrey's UFO, well, they convince Alan Godfrey, why don't you undergo regressive hypnosis to see what, because there's obviously missing time from when he saw the object to when he's on the other side of the object. How did he get there? The object's gone. So he undergoes regressive hypnosis. And what he finds out is that he was taken aboard a craft, at least that's what's in his mind. He was taken aboard a craft, and they were doing medical experiments on him on the craft. Well, his folks at the local constabulary, our modern police precinct, are furious about the publicity. And they tell him, you stop these regressive hypnosis sessions. That's the end of this. And he's getting a lot of flack from people in his police department. They're saying, oh, you're a UFO nut, you're crazy, you're this. So he's getting a lot of abuse about this. They force him to stop. Then what they do, now get this, they get him to sign a national security letter. It's a letter in which they lay out what the material is that he is under the strictures of national security. He can be punished for this thing, go to jail. He cannot talk about. In that letter, they link the body, the guy's name is Sigmund Adamski. They link the body on top of the coal heap with the UFO in the national security letter. Ask yourself this question, which is what I ask myself. If the guy died of natural causes, because the coroner said he was climbing up a coal heap and died, why would that be in a national security letter with a UFO? One of the great cases. And you could speculate all you want to.
That's a terrific story, and you tell it so well in the book, and it does raise so many questions. I mean, how can it be a national security matter for something that the government says doesn't exist, both our government and their government? I'm going to go to the phone lines and take a couple of calls east of the Rockies. Gary in Tampa, Florida. Good morning, Gary.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call, George.
Sure.
Mr. Burns, I wanted to tell you, I loved UFO Hunters. I used to arrange my schedule to ensure that I could catch every new episode. And I've got a couple of questions for you. You might have just answered it, but I wanted to know, what was the most compelling evidence that you folks analyzed? And also, I noticed on several shows that you're wearing a Navy pea coat with a third-class ET emblem on the sleeve. And I was wondering, were you an ET in the Navy? And if so, do you remember what your NEC was? And
no, I wasn't. And to answer the question real quick, that was a present. One of our neighbors in California got promoted from his rating to a petty officer. And so and I knew the guy. He lived near us. He said, here, you know, take this pea coat. I'm not going to ever use it again. So I did. And eventually I realized that rating on the sleeve was very misleading. So I took it off. So no, I was never in the Navy and I was never a rated seaman. The compelling evidence for me, there were three pieces of compelling evidence. One, of course, was the image of a UFO, because we knew that it wasn't a naturally occurring object over Area 51, the episode where obviously George Knapp was our guest, over Area 51, that photograph, which we took from 24-hour surveillance cameras, that was one. Two was the object that I talked about, this shard that came out of a person who said he was abducted by extraterrestrials, where his skin was growing out of metal. It wasn't just attached. It was actually growing out of the metal. It was a part of it. Then the third thing, which was fascinating to me, besides the Alan Godfrey story, the third thing was when we were talking about the Kiami Desert UFO crash, we actually found the material from the Deneb report buried and blown up and burned in the Kiami Desert. So we actually confirmed, at least in part, what was in the Deneb report when we found a mine shaft dug by someone filled with volatile liquid, and we found the explosives in the liquid, and we knew exactly that it was in that area because when we walked out to the sand on the other side of it, there was no volatile liquid, and the area itself was fenced off in the middle of a desert. Why? Those are the three things.
Good question, Gary. We didn't even get a chance to talk about the Area 51 episode, Bill, but you note in the book that it was the highest rated episode for, at least for season two, I guess, in large part because of that amazing footage that you got.
The footage was incredible. And in fact, if you notice, one of the things that happened was other shows copied our footage. They did the same thing we did. They lugged the huge telephoto lens up Tickaboo Peak and focused it inside to get a shot of Area 51 at dawn. And of course, we had the surveillance footage from showing the light over Area 51. So, yeah. Other folks tried to do it. They did the same thing with our season, with our first episode of season three, when we worked with George Tsoukalos on that alien, on that bird alien artifact, where we did the experiment with would the bird fly if we scaled it up from a piece of jewelry. And then the first episode of Ancient Aliens, which came from UFO Hunters, was that same test.
Ryan in Washington State on the wild card line. Hi, Ryan.
Hi, how's it going, guys? I'll get this fast. You got other callers. Have you ever, your guest, have you ever read the MJ-12 document or ever worked with Stanton Friedman? You guys have a good night, all right?
Okay, Ryan.
Yes and yes. Read the MJ-12 documents. Stan's a very good friend of mine.
What do you think of them? What's your take?
I think they're very compelling. Now, you've got Kevin Randall on the one side saying they're really not true, although it's probably likely there was some committee. Then you've got Bob Wood and the others on the other side. I think what bothers me most is how the MJ documents came into the possession of Jamie Chandray, who I also know. It's like they suddenly turn up in a mailbox, and that's how they get there. And you wonder why. How did they get filtered in? But when you look at the people in the MJ-12 documents, and this is what Stanton has pointed out, and he's right about this, everybody who's in those documents would have been in exactly the right position to have been people involved in the overview of what happened at Roswell in 1947. And when you look at how Eisenhower, you look at two things. One, in July 1952, this is right before the election in which Eisenhower won, in July 1952, after the invasion of Washington, President Harry Truman is on the radio. Literally, if you ever wanted disclosure, it happened in 1952. Harry Truman is on the radio saying, oh, well, these things are UFOs and we know what they are. So look at that two-part statement. These things are UFOs. So here's a president saying that the lights over Washington, D.C., and if you read the Edward Ruppelt book about what happened, you know these are not just lights, that the lights over D.C. are actually UFOs. That's one. Two, we know what they are, right?
We have a similar statement from Margaret Thatcher that you quote in the book as well, something similar and enigmatic.
Yeah, when after Bentwater, she said, oh, some things we just do not talk about, exactly, these enigmatic statements. So Eisenhower, who was on board the USS Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the aircraft carrier in Operation Mainbrace out in the North Sea, actually sees a USO come out of the water and fly away. Now, that Operation Mainbrace was NATO's first nuclear exercise to block the Soviet Union from getting their submarines from the North Sea into the Atlantic. There was a very important NATO exercise. Eisenhower is there. He sees this. He tells somebody on the bridge, we're not going to talk about it. Then Eisenhower comes into office and gets briefing documents about what happened at Roswell. It makes perfect sense.
I'm afraid about going to another call because I don't want to run out of time in the middle of it. So let me end with this. Bill, you know, you've been at this for a long time. You've been all over the world, have investigated all kinds of cases. You wrote this book, UFO Hunters. You wrote the book with Corso. Basing your approach on the Sherlock Holmes model of eliminating possibilities, possible explanations and you're left with unpleasant facts sometimes. It doesn't matter how much evidence you come up with. There are going to be those who will not believe because they don't want to believe. Evidence really doesn't even come into it, does it?
No, it doesn't. I mean, at the end of the day, what you find out is something that Stan Friedman said, which makes perfect sense. Anything but aliens. And you will see people go into more illogic to deny the reality of facts than simply, it's called a plausibility test. I have seen arguments that are so implausible to explain what happened, like in Aria of Bentwaters, the implausibility of saying that it was the Orford Ness Lighthouse that caused the light that Charles Hall and the Air Force personnel were following when we actually went to the very clearing where he saw the light from the object flaming in the farmer's field. We did a GPS location of where the Orford Ness Lighthouse would hit, and they were in two, and this was in the book, there were two different spots, so it could not possibly have been the Orford Ness Lighthouse. Then we went to the lighthouse itself and spoke to the lighthouse keeper, this guy named, oddly enough, Seaman, and he said that the light couldn't have played across the clearing because there was a bar across the light that kept it from playing across the land. And, of course, Charles Hall said all the people at Bentwaters, at Aria Bentwaters, knew about the lighthouse because you could see it from the runway. None of that made one single impression on the skeptics and debunkers, even though we absolutely eliminated their argument for what Charles Holt and James Peniston and the others saw in the forest.
Well, people who are uncomfortable with it and don't want it to be true, it isn't a matter of scientific inquiry or fair inquiry. They just aren't going to believe it, even if you had the proverbial landing on the White House lawn. Bill, I greatly enjoyed the book. It's very entertaining. UFO Hunters, Book 1. And I look forward to reading Book 2 as well. I wish you well in all your many endeavors.
Thank you, sir, and we will talk soon.
And thank you as well for joining us. Thanks to all my crew there at our crew there at Premier, Gina and David, Dan Galante and Webmaster Tim. And I'll be back next Sunday night. Good night, everyone.